Teachers and Their Bright Ideas by Dr. Mike Goldsmith, illustrated by Clive Goddard, read by Vienna Vance. Introduction. If it wasn't for whoever it was who invented reading and whoever else it was who invented introductions, you wouldn't be reading this introduction now. It's a stunning thought, isn't it? Good old inventors. You can probably think of loads of them and the great things they invented. James Watt and the steam machine, George Stephenson and the train, John Logie Baird and the telly, Edison and the light bulb, the Wright brothers and the flying machine, Marconi and the radio. Everyone knows about them, don't they? But everyone's wrong. Lucky you bought this book, really. The thing is, dead famous inventors have got a bit of tendency not to have done what they're famous for. This book is just full of surprises like that, not to mention a talking dog. But you will find out who did invent all these great things, as well as why the people in this book really do deserve their fame, because they're more to be an inventor than being first to think something up. Such as, well, an inventor can be the first person to think of something up, which would make Leonardo a really terrific inventor. But they can also be the person who made the first version of something, like Thomas Edison. The first person to make something work really well, so that everyone wanted one, like Guglielmo Marconi. The first person to patent something, to find out all about patenting later on page 37, like Alexander Graham Bell. In this book, inventor can mean any of those things. Between them, these inventors come up with a good chunk of the world's most important inventions, but not all of them. Some really brilliant things have unknown inventors, like wheels, clocks, and pockets. Others were invented by teams of people, often taking decades or even centuries to get them right, like the computer, the spaceship, or the piano, which took over 2,000 years and over 2,000 other inventions to perfect. Because this book is about famous inventors, not famous inventions. These don't get a look in. You'll also notice that the inventors in this book stop inventing somewhere around the 1930s. That's because from then on most inventions, like CDs, instant noodles, and satellites, were thought up by big companies. But if you want to be an inventor yourself, don't worry. There are still people inventing marvelous things that make them rich and famous. And there are certainly plenty left to invent. Like me! So read on and find out why the Roman army was terrified of an old mathematician, why miners used to dress up in rotting fish skins, who experimented with a disembodied human ear, why elephants can't fly, what Frankenstein really invented. To start with, let's go back a long way in time to one of the greatest and oldest inventors of all, only he didn't want to be one. Ancient Archimedes and his menacing machinery. Archimedes is not only very famous, he's also very dead. He lived over 2,000 years ago. In those days, no one had got around to inventing much yet. The problem with Archimedes being so incredibly ancient is that, though there are loads of stories about him, it's hard to know which are true. Apart from a few of his own writings, we often have to rely on copies of books written by people who lived long after Archimedes, but whose granny's uncle once met him at a party. Even Cicero, a Roman historian who did some proper research into Archimedes, lived over 3 centuries later. This all means that some of the things Archimedes is famous for probably never happened. He ran naked down a street shouting, "Eureka!" because he invented, streaking? Eureka! He's famous for inventing lever and saying, "Give me a place to stand and I shall move the earth." He invented a special deadly heat ray that totally zapped invading ships. Zap. But he still did a lot of amazing things, like launching a ship all by himself, building a giant claw and using it to sink ships, making a working model of the solar system, and he was definitely one of the greatest mathematicians ever. Mathematician? I thought you were an inventor. Who, me? Startling sounds. Maths was by far Archimedes' favorite thing to do. All his surviving books were about it, and he much preferred it to inventing. He probably wouldn't be famous as an inventor if the Romans hadn't tried to secret everyone in the city. Anyway, Archimedes was born in 287 BC in Syracuse, a seaside town in Sicily. His dad was an astronomer, and his family might have been related to the king, Hierion II. When he was a young man, Archimedes went off to Alexandria in Egypt to study. Alexandria was famous for two stunning things, a massive lighthouse called the Pharos, which was one of the 7 wonders of the world, and the only one that was actually any use, and an incredible library, which wasn't. Welcome to Alexandria, home of the great pharaohs and Smotherstone too. People from all over the place went to the library, and it contained all the knowledge of the world in the form of hundreds of thousands of texts, including probably plans of loads of inventions. Sadly, it was burnt down 3 times over the centuries, and now there's nothing left of it. The pharaohs lasted longer, but after being damaged by an earthquake in AD 365 and another one in 1303, it finally collapsed in 1326. The Alexandrians must have been dead impressed with Archimedes, because when he went back to Syracuse, they asked him to keep sending them his mathematical discoveries. Archimedes was quite happy to do that, until he heard that some Alexandrians were passing off his theorems as their own. So next time he sent his results, he put in a few false statements as well, so the sneaky Alexandrian mathematicians would get their sums wrong. Dear Archimedes, Alexandrians, Alexandria, Egypt, Tuesday, 265 BC. Dear Archimedes, hope you are keeping well. We're fine, though quite a lot of us have died of plague lately. Still, mustn't grumble. Thanks for the sums. Amazing stuff. All the other cities can't believe your proof that 2 plus 2 equals 5. In fact, they all think you've gone nuts. Little do they know, eh, Archie? By the way, you do seem to have left a few lines out of your proof. You couldn't send us another copy, could you? No rush. Whatever. Still, no time like the present, as the philosophers say. All the best from your pals, the Alexandrians. Back in Syracuse, Archimedes was spending so much time doing maps, he often forgot to bathe or eat. When he did get round to having a nice oily bath, there wasn't much punch anyway, because he'd only write sums on himself, using grime and ashes from the fire. I've got some really interesting sums on my left thigh. Maths in those days meant geometry, and Archimedes thought it was such fun he even made a geometrical study of a popular game in which differently shaped pieces could be rearranged to form patterns. One of the many things that hadn't been invented yet was advertising. Otherwise, the game might have been called Sneaker or Kerpling. Actually, its name means something like stomach, which is odd, really. Anyway, Archimedes was really amazing at maths. He discovered the geometrical relationship between a sphere and a cylinder, which was rather clever and very handy, but we haven't got time to find out about it now. Good heavens, how nifty. He also worked out a new way to estimate the value of n, the number of times the diameter of a circle can fit into its circumference, very popular with mathematicians, gardeners, architects, engineers, and anyone else who uses circles, as well as coming up with a way of expressing very large numbers, which turned out to be really useful for later mathematicians, as well as for Archimedes himself, who worked out how many grains of sand it would take to fill the universe, which turned out to be quite a few. And he devised the very first version of what is now called an integration, which is a way of working out the area of a shape by dividing it up into lots of little bits of known area and adding them together. Almost any serious scientific maths now involves integration. Macho machinery. But as well as all this, and even though he wasn't terribly keen on the idea, Archimedes did actually invent things too. One of these inventions amazed everyone. It was a way of enormously increasing a person's strength, or so it seemed. It said that to convince people, Archimedes organized a public demonstration. A thick rope was attached to a huge, fully laden ship that was ready to be launched, and Archimedes connected the other end to his invention on the far side of the harbor. When his audience was in place, Archimedes began to pull on a second rope connected to the other side of his machine, and the rope connected to the ship. First tautened, and then very slowly dragged the ship into the sea. Everyone was amazed. How could the machine have made him so much stronger? Ooh! Actually, it hadn't. The invention was an arrangement of pulleys, each of which worked like this. Between the upper picture and the lower one, Archimedes has put out 1 meter of rope, but this only results in the ship moving half a meter. As you can see, this is bound to happen. It's the only way Archimedes' rope can stay the same total length, which is 5 meters. Just add up the labeled lengths in the pictures. So the end of his rope moves twice as far as the ship's rope does, but the ship's rope pulls on the ship twice as hard as Archimedes pulls on his rope. It's a bit like using a claw hammer to lever a nail out. You move your end a long way with a smallish burst, while the claw end moves a short distance with a lot more burst. By linking together lots of these pulleys, Archimedes could increase this effect many times, so he really could use his invention to move weights far heavier than he could have done otherwise. Machines like this were incredibly useful, especially for loading ships and for moving building materials. One thing Archimedes didn't invent is something called the Archimedean screw, which had been in use for some time in Egypt. He may have introduced it to Syracuse, though. The Archimedean screw was a letter cup, and it looks like this. It works just like a cleric screw. As you rotate a cleric screw into a cleric, make the cleric move up the length of the screw. The only difference is that the Archimedean screw has a cylinder around it to stop the matter falling out of the sides. It's not surprising that Archimedes liked the screw, since screws and cylinders were two of his favorite shapes, and it must have seemed as magical as his pulley machine to people who didn't know how it worked, which was everyone. It came in very useful when one of King Hieron's big boats had been left out in the rain and had filled with water. Hieron asked Archimedes to give him a hand to empty it, and Archimedes used an Archimedean screw to do the job. The screws probably became known by Archimedes' name because he went on about them so much. They're still used today, pumping all sorts of things for blood. For people whose hearts aren't up to it themselves, to rainwater, they give a nice smooth flow and don't mind a few lumpy bits, unlike other sorts of pumps. Archimedes, private investigator. Hieron also asked Archimedes to be his detective. He had a shiny new crown made from by a goldsmith. No relation, well, probably not. And he'd given the goldsmith a big lump of gold to make it with. The crown weighed the same as the lump, but for some reason, Hieron was suspicious. Rich! Rich! I'm rich at last! Hieron wondered whether the crown was really made of pure gold. Maybe the goldsmith had substituted some of the gold for silver and kept the rest for himself. Could Archimedes help? He could indeed. After a bit of a think and a quick bath, he had it sussed. Supposedly following the bath, Eureka! So, Archimedes had come up with a brilliant way of finding out whether the gold crown really was made of gold. He did it by realizing that, because gold is heavier than silver, a block of gold with the same volume as the crown must weigh the same as the crown, unless the crown was made from a mixture of gold and silver. And he came up with a marvelously clever way of measuring the volume of the crown when he realized that the volume of matter displaced by a submerged object is the same volume as the submerged object. Part of the same volume as crown. Part of the same volume as Archimedes. Nope. Clever, eh? Wouldn't you want to rush about naked after discovering that? Why experiment later? So, is my crown made of pure gold? No. No? Well, that's right. I meant to give the leftovers to you. They're in Tibet at the moment. I'll just nip off and get them. For most of his life, Archimedes was almost certainly better known as a mathematician than an inventor. In fact, it wasn't until he was an old man that he spent very much time inventing. But then, thanks to the warlike Romans, he had to invent lots of things. Big, dangerous things. Trouble with Romans. In Archimedes' time, Syracuse was in a bit of a tricky position. It was part of Greece, but not far off to the west, with a powerful and bad-tempered place called Carthage. Up north, the Romans were, as usual, in a conquest of the earth kind of mood. They wanted to take control of Carthage, but Syracuse and other Greek cities were in the way. But the Romans weren't going to let a little thing like that stop them. When Archimedes was 23, war broke out between Carthage and Rome. To start with, Syracuse was on the side of Carthage, but the Romans offered some clever and reasoned arguments that convinced King Hieron it would be less painful, not to mention bloody, for everyone if he supported them. So he did. That sounds very reasonable. For a while, everything was peaceful, in a violent kind of way, until the Greek Gazette, 218 BC, elephants make Romans pack their trunks. For the first time in far too long, those rascally Romans have been defeated by a brave band of Carthaginian elephants led over the Alps by General Hannibal. It was easy, said Hannibal. The only dodgy moment was when the Romans cut off the bun supply. The story on page 3. Pillar reveals Syracuse split on Romans. Published today, a major poll of Syracusans shows strong opinions about Romans, with 38% ticking the "they're really annoying, they're always getting drunk and shouting, not like those nice Carthaginians" box, while 52% said, "I like them, they might be animals, but they're party animals." See page 6 for full details. On page 7, when Hannibal's hat in our exclusive Spot the Elephant competition. The Greek Gazette, 217 BC, Death of a King, exclusive 8-page color pull-out section with photos of Hieron's funeral procession, third report of Hieronymus succession, and 5-year play on page 2. On page 12, your chance by a limited edition, handcrafted Hieronymus mouth will be yours to treasure forever. King Hieronymus forever. The Greek Gazette, 216 BC. Hieronymus assassinated by pro-Roman Syracusans. Pro-Carthaginian Syracusans, very irritated indeed. The Syracusans who supported the Romans had really gone a bit far this time. By assassinating the king of Syracuse, they sparked off a civil war. It didn't take long, though, before the war in Syracuse was over. The pro-Carthaginians had won. Rather unsurprisingly, the Romans weren't best pleased with them. The Greek Gazette, 213 BC. Romans sent in the frighteners. Roman generals Appius Claudius Pulcher and Marcus Claudius Marcellus are on their way to besiege Syracuse, accompanied by 1,000 troops and 60 battleships. Rumor has it by the charm offensive by the citizens of nearby Leontini, got off to a bad start when Marcellus had them all beheaded. The Greek Gazette, 213 BC. Hide under the bed, Syracuse's advised. In another attack today, Marcus Claudius Marcellus attacked Syracuse with 60 battleships, while his mate, Appius Claudius Pincher, attacked the landward side of the city with his troops. By this stage, Archimedes was 73, which was ever so old in those days. Most people were dead by 30, and probably wanted a quiet life. He certainly didn't want to be distracted from his stomachs by having to invent things. The Hippocrates and Epictetus, the latest rulers of Syracuse, were getting a little bit edgy, what with all the besieging and beheading and Latin and so on, and they decided they needed a bit of help. So Archimedes, no doubt with a certain amount of muttering and tut-tutting, got to work building war machines. He made huge catapults that could hurl heavy rocks or massive beams of wood at people, special deadly crossbows called scorpions, and scariest of all, the claw. It's not quite certain how the claw worked. There was probably a special grappling iron that could be swung onto a ship by a crane.
Heave, creak, boing, sprucey!
When it had grabbed something, the claw was jerked up, dragging the end of the ship with it. Then the claw was suddenly released, and the ship would crash back into the sea and capsize. The claw was also used to grab and drop individual Roman soldiers, which served them right. Some historians said that Archimedes also built huge mirrors of polished bronze to focus the sun's heat on the ships and set them on fire. This seems unlikely. For one thing, the most reliable Greek historians don't mention it, and for another, it would have taken an awful lot of mirrors. On the other hand, it's not impossible. Experiments done since in the same harbor have shown that. If it was nice and sunny, it could have happened. The Romans had no chance against Archimedes and his machines. They had some war machines of their own, including Sambucae, which were scaling ladders mounted on boats. But they were a bit pathetic compared to Archimedes' machines.
Oh, it's the claw!
He used them to drag the Sambuca ships around until they were full of water and all the sailors had swum away. It was all very annoying, but Marcus Claudius Marcellus, the leader of the Roman force, didn't lose his well-known sense of humor, saying, Archimedes uses my ships to ladle sea water into his wine cups, but my Sambuca band have been whipped out of the wine party as intruders. Even though it doesn't make a lot of sense, it must be the sort of joke that had people laughing their heads off in those days. Or maybe their heads came off if they didn't laugh. So the Romans had nothing to do but lay siege to Syracuse for the next 2 years. Finally, in 212 BC, when the Syracusans were having a big party, the Romans sneaked in and attacked them just as they were getting round to the Trifon. Marcus instructed his soldiers not to kill Archimedes. He probably wanted him to build an automatic head-chopping-off machine. When a Roman soldier found him, Archimedes was busily working on yet more diagrams. He refused to leave his calculations until he was finished, but the soldier had no time for that sort of thing and killed him. Marcus wasn't happy, but there wasn't a lot he could do, so he contented himself with stealing Archimedes' inventions instead. One of these was a globe showing positions of the stars, which Marcus gave to a temple in Rome. Another was a mysterious metal object, which so amazed Marcus that he kept it for himself. It was probably a moving mechanical model of the solar system. Cicero said that only a godlike being could have made such a thing. Cicero also tracked down Archimedes' tomb. A lot of the inscriptions had been worn away by then, but a diagram of the sphere within a cylinder could still be seen. Archimedes, that was your life. Chapter mentions compound pili, war machines, model of the solar system. Also dead famous for being one of the greatest mathematicians ever. Leonardo da Vinci and his secret submarine. Leonardo da Vinci invented the submarine, the glider, and the tank 500 years ago. And the first submarine was built in 1620, the first manned glider flew in 1839, and the first tanks were used in the 1910s. Huh? Exactly. Most of Leonardo's inventions were lost and had to be reinvented all over again centuries later. It was all because Leonardo was a Renaissance man. The Renaissance was a period in which ancient Greek manuscripts, full of brilliant ideas, were brought to Italy. Everyone was very impressed, and suddenly they got to all sorts of arts and the odd bit of science, too. The idea of being a Renaissance person was that you should know about all subjects. So ideally, people didn't specialize in being scientists or writers or synchronized swimmers. They were annoyingly good at everything. It was a good scheme, if tricky, but Leonardo had it sussed. In fact, he was probably the Renaissance man. He was one of the greatest painters ever. He drew maps, he made sculptures, he looked at the stars, he composed and performed music on instruments he invented and built himself. He studied rocks, he designed buildings, and even towns. He drew plants and fossils, he cut people up without spilling a drop of blood. It's okay, they were dead. Which is just as well, since he also injected wax into their hearts and brains so he can make nice meds of them. Their daughter was also really good looking, ever so athletic, had amazing eyesight, and was very strong indeed. He's supposed to have bet Hershey's with one hand. And he was a very kind bloke, a vegetarian who bought caged birds so that he could let them go. My hero! And, of course, he was an inventor. Being a Renaissance man meant that Leonardo was really busy. He kept lots of notebooks, full of stunning ideas and brilliant illustrations, but he never got around to sorting them out and getting them published. Also, he was a bit concerned people would steal his ideas or use them to kill each other, and he was often on the move. So while he was alive, lots of his inventions were known only to him. After he was dead, his papers were scattered around the world, and most of the people who got hold of them were artists, because the idea of being Renaissance people had gone out of fashion by then. So his more sciencey stuff was ignored. This happens even now. Books about Leonardo tend to concentrate rarely on his art, which would probably have got on his nerves. Jet-propelled germs. Leonardo was born near Vinci in Tuscany in 1352. We don't know much about his early life, but we do know that he grew up in an exciting but unsettled time. Italy was divided into five main areas, each dominated by a big city: Rome, Florence, Milan, Venice, and Naples. The areas were controlled mostly by ruthless families. Leonardo worked for two of them, the Borghese and the Medicis. Although they were, by and large, herder, they were into art. They were also, generally speaking, at war with each other, as well as with Turkey and France. So they liked artists, and they liked people who could build them weapons. Leonardo could do both, so they liked him a lot. To begin with, Leonardo was more into art than science. In 1369, he was taken on at the workshop of Braccio, a famous artist. It said that Leonardo helped Braccio finish the portrait by painting a head. Braccio said, "Blimey, that's so great I'm retiring," or he said in 15th century Italian. Well, maybe. Anyway, Leonardo was a great artist. He drew rocks and water and animals and people, and he once terrified his dad by painting a monster and setting it up in a darkened room with a light shining on it. Leonardo was gay, and homosexuality was then treated as a crime, punishable by being burnt at the stake. He was anonymously accused of being gay in 1376, and though the charge was dismissed, it was one reason why he left Florence for Milan soon after. By this time, he was already at least as interested in science, engineering, as art, and he wrote a letter to Ludovico Sforza, ruler of Milan, listing all the amazing things he could invent to help him with whatever war he happened to be having just then. Things like indestructible bridges and stone-throwing machines. He mentioned he could paint a bit, too. And sure enough, in 1382, Ludovico took him on as a lyre player. Luckily, he could do that as well. Being a lyre player didn't stop Leonardo inventing. The fact he was really into peace didn't stop him thinking up a lot of weapons of war. Leonardo's lost sketchpads, scaling ladder, anti-scaling ladder device, tank, steam-powered cannon, spiky, assertive projectiles filled with saliva of mad dog, plane,